the fan. On demand. Log on to Sportsnet590.ca. Sign up to automatically receive the latest reports, features, and Fan 590 show highlights. Track a sports story throughout the day, and you can follow it back to where it all began. Right here on Brady and Lang in the Morning. Sportsnet 590. The Fan.
Monday morning in Brady and Lang. Jim Lang, Mike Farwell, Greg Brady. And what a Monday it is, the day after the U.S. Open. Justin Rose victorious, beating out Phil Mickelson. Mickelson, a second-place finish at the U.S. Open for the sixth time in his career. The San Antonio Spurs are heading to Miami with a 3-2 series lead after another convincing win over the Heat, 114-104. And the big story in Toronto, the Blue Jays completing an improbable four-game sweep of the Texas Rangers, where they outscored Texas 24-4 in the four games. The starting pitching was magnificent, and Adam Lind continues, Mike, to be the hottest hitter right now in the American League in the last 3 weeks.
And don't look now, Jim, but you go back a week from today. It was last Monday night the Blue Jays opened a six-game road trip. Well, it was supposed to be seven, but they had the third game with the White Sox postponed by that nasty, nasty weather last week. But you go back to game one of that series at the new Comiskey, or U.S. Cellular as it is now, and they lose that game, and then they go off to win five consecutive. Last Tuesday, the postponement on Wednesday, then four straight over the Rangers. And with that five-game winning streak, the Blue Jays now just four games under 500 and 5.5 back in the wild card race.
Of all the series to sweep, a four-gamer in Texas, probably the least likely of all of them, considering the way Texas have played going into the series, how well they've looked. Now Texas is staring at a six-game losing streak, and the Blue Jays taking on a middling Colorado Rockies team tonight at Rogers Center for, I guess they're just over 500 now. They had scuffled a little bit, but now it's a kind of exciting times at Rogers Center, and there's expectations that Josh Johnson will continue on what the starting pitching has done the last four nights.
I think it's early.
early to be talking about playoffs, back
right,
in it.
Yeah. It was early to eliminate them, and now it might be early to have them back in it. It's always early. It's never late. It's always early. It's never on time, but it might be early.
Are you I'm talking serious. About the start to your day or just this
no,
whole
the Blue
season?
Jays. The Blue Jays. It may be way early. I mean, six teams ahead of them. You got to hop over a bunch of them to even think about going on the road and playing the 163rd game. Not getting a home game of your own unless you can win it. So, Texas is swooning right now. There's no rhyme or reason for why their bats are so ice cold. But they lost two out of three coming into the series. I can't put my finger on how decisively the Blue Jays won, but they were due for it, and the talent's there. But it's sort of how they did it, with not the pitchers we might have expected them to do it with at the start of the season. With Wong winning yesterday, with Mike, as we talked about Friday, with them shutting Darvish down, still getting a victory out of it with Esmail Rogers. So you expect what you got from Burley and Dickey. It's the bookends of the series, Wong and Rogers, that are hugely beneficial for them. We'll see if they can keep it going. I'm skeptical they can, but the team's playing better baseball, and they're at least going to make July interesting.
There's absolutely no doubt about that. And your point with all the teams in front of them, very well taken. 5.5 games back in the wild card looks nice until you see those other teams that are there. But the one thing I believe you can focus on here is the four games below 500. You go back to the comments R.A. Dickey made, and it's pretty much a well-worn cliche in baseball. If we can be 500 at the All-Star break for a team that's struggling, four games below makes that very realistic, and that's completely in the Blue Jays' control.
And what kind of, if you're going to get Jose Reyes back, that's great. What kind of Jose Reyes are you getting back? Is he the excellent player that was there before the start, before he was injured in Kansas City? Is he a little bit worse? Is he far less reliable? They have to take their time with this. They can't do it without him, so he has to be really good coming back whenever he does come back, 3 weeks from now, 4 weeks from now, whenever.
And he's playing in simulated games, what the reports I've read, and down in Dunedin, getting ready to actually go to a full rehab assignment. So he seems to be ahead of schedule. But to your point, Greg, you're absolutely right. If he's going to come back, he's got to be the leadoff hitter, and an effective, mm-hmm. productive leadoff hitter like he was before he got hurt, to set the rest of the lineup up.
Yeah, what a great sports weekend, though. Not just that, but, I mean, enjoy it while it lasts, because soon it'll kind of just be baseball. You're going to have Wimbledon start next weekend. You'll have the British Open in a few weeks, obviously. And so you have a great golf major championship. you end up having two fantastic, I mean, the one was Wednesday, obviously, but two fantastic Stanley Cup Finals games. And obviously, you know, baseball kind of back, at least more in the frontal lobe for a lot of people in Toronto.
I can't imagine a Stanley Cup Finals I can remember recently where two good teams as well as Chicago and Boston have played that tightly in the first two games.
That was Vancouver and Boston 2 years ago.
Well, in New Jersey and L.A., I believe, went to overtime both the first two games of last year's final as well.
So there you go.
I just find these two teams are just so evenly matched and so close in so many ways. I fully expect to see more of that.
Yeah, but I think we've had two really good teams. The Pittsburgh and Detroit were like that. I think we've had a lot recently. It just hasn't gone to overtime. We'll all be looking at it tonight. If it's 1-1 game with 18 minutes left, we'll think, is this it again? And does it last 20 minutes? Does it last 60 minutes, you know, in terms of the overtime? Does it go just a double overtime tonight?
That's the one thing about it.
And the players might be thinking, the coach is the same thing.
If they only play three periods tonight, start cutting back on those Stanley Cup bonuses. Come on. We're getting used to this 4, 5, 6 period stuff.
I'd go to the shootout tonight. I love it. I mean, just three skaters each. Get down to 4-on-4 early.
It's such a good thing.
Nobody ever leaves those games.
I know. And everybody loves it so much. I don't know why they don't keep doing it in the playoffs.
So lots to get to. Jays Baltimore tickets we'll give away for Friday. As Jim mentioned, the Colorado Rockies in town for three starting tonight with one of their big hitters. And we'll also talk about Seattle and the potential for the Phoenix Coyotes to be the Seattle Coyotes, not a couple of years from now, a few months from now. It's Brady and Lang, Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Now, more of Brady and Lang on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
First is the Nicholas Medal in recognition of your victory and the place that you take in history with four-time United States Open champion Jack Nicklaus. And second, I have the honor of presenting you with the United States Open trophy, the time-honored emblem of our national championship.
I'm Justin Rose. I'm like, where's the check? Great medal, better trophy. Check is good. The bank's open tomorrow morning at 9. You don't have my drink. You know, I can't give you. Can I give you a void one of mine so you can direct deposit it? Get me on the payroll.
And does the U.S. Open give the big checks like Happy Gilmore? This says $1.4 million on it.
Or the Price is Right. Yeah. Justin Rose is the U.S. Open champion. No top five finishes since 2007 outside of the PGA. I meant at the U.S. Open. Was there in 2003, finishing fifth. First Englishman to win a major since Nick Faldo on Greg Norman's collapse in the 96 Masters. And he gets it done at age 32 when, let's face it, there were some that started to wonder, is it, it's like moving day, meaning getting ready for the cut on the Friday. But is it moving day for his career in terms of being a guy that you consider a great candidate to win a major, or a guy that's just kind of hanging out, playing the tour, winning once in a while, winning on the European tour once in a while, and he wins it at age 32.
And he was full marks for it. And this was more of a case of Justin winning it and beating out the competition, I felt, than other guys blowing it. He played a magnificent final round. He was great in the second round and made some clutch shots in the back nine to win the whole thing when other golfers either weren't making putts or shanking balls all over that course in the back nine on Sunday. He just stuck to his guns and had a great game plan.
Phil Mickelson finished the second, tied with Jason Day, who's had his own breakthrough, obviously, recently, at 3 over par. Four golfers back at 5 over. And Luke Donald, who many had pegged to do good things, shot a 68 opening day, was there with Phil Mickelson. At the end of the Thursday, he hadn't finished his round, but he was leading at the end of the Thursday, was sitting right there ready to go. He shot a 75 yesterday, and he's still looking for his first major.
Luke Donald, not only did he shoot 75, he hit one in the creek, hit one in the sand, and hit a poor volunteer in the head with a wayward tee shot.
Could have been a rich volunteer, but okay.
But she was standing on the fairway looking at the other hole as a marker, looking to see if a ball hit the rough and hit her in the back of the head. And he took a driver out in a short par 4, that was just under 300 yards, and they were like, why is he driving? Why is he not using an iron or a 3-wood? Sprays it and clonks her in the head because she was looking the other way.
Yeah. Then there's audio from it. There's a courtesy NBC. But the amazing thing is that with Mickelson, all the coverage afterwards was, here's what he didn't do. Here's him blowing this drive. Here's him not making this putt. Here's him when he should have laid up, and he didn't. Hey, here's him not holing out from 180 yards to try and win the thing. I've never noticed it as much before, and maybe I've just been blind to it, but there we go. There's 6 second-place finishes in the U.S. Open. He has 23 top five finishes now. Tiger Woods has 32 in his career. And all the story was Phil lost. Phil didn't win. Phil could have won, but he didn't. But he was leading today, but now he's not. And you'd never know. You'd never know this guy in his back pocket. You would think he was still majorless the way he was treated after by NBC. I thought it was disgusting, to be perfectly honest, to play it out this way. He's got four major championships. It's remarkable to me that they did this way to Phil Mickelson. I hope he gets wind of it. I do.
Well, it's also unfair to Justin Rose. Shouldn't the post-broadcast celebration be about the accomplishment of Justin Rose's first major and what he did right on a Sunday when the course was crushing everybody? Tiger Woods, Roy McIlroy, Adam Scott were combined plus 42 in the tournament. Yet Justin Rose ends up one over after four rounds because he played that well.
Yeah, I think that's the biggest part of this is the fact that the story became who finished second as opposed to who won the damn thing being Justin Rose. So that's where the narrative breaks down for me. As for Mickelson finishing second, well, six times second now at this tournament, and you have to look at it and just consider. I mean, what if he wins two of those and he's all of a sudden got six majors under his belt? Half of them, he's got seven majors under his belt. The numbers could be so much more striking for Phil. And I don't know if you say he coughed it up or not, but to go four over when the guy behind you was going even par for the day to take the win away, there is a story to be told there. There absolutely is.
Yeah, there is. But I think it's overdone by the networks. I don't think there's anybody else outside of Tiger Woods who finishes second who the story is so much about at that point. And, you know, you got his, I don't know how that hurts more than his 2006, I am such an idiot, U.S. Open, when he hit when he pulled out the driver on 18, hit it off the food and beverage tent, basically. I don't know how that hurts worse. And I look at guys that left yesterday. Lee Westwood's 40. He's 40. He's a really good golfer. He's never sniffed a major. You know, honestly, he's got two second-place finishes in his career. Well, now, what, Phil has like eight of those, nine of those. So, you know, Phil, it's never about Lee Westwood. It's never about Luke Donald. It's never about the guys that don't get it. It used to be like that. It used to be, hey, this guy came close again. And oftentimes that guy was Phil, and he used to be Payne Stewart, and he used to be Justin Leonard. And now that it's just like we're obsessed with Phil. Phil's great. I don't mind him getting the coverage. And I think it's a little over dramatized what he did going back for his daughter's graduation, but he did it and he slept well and he looked great on Thursday. I don't think he was tired by the end of yesterday. He just couldn't make a putt, and that happens.
And Justin Rose, I mean, you would need to take a tape of that and show it to every athlete how to be gracious in victory after winning a tournament like that. His post-game speech was one for the ages and acknowledged beat Mickelson and acknowledge what he did. And that's where it should have ended right there. It made NBC making mention of how nice of Justin Rose to do this, but let's go to Johnny Miller. How did he win it?
Yeah.
And talk to people, and how did he actually accomplish this great feat for his career?
We'll talk later in the morning about the news on the weekend about Seattle and the NHL and the Phoenix Coyotes. And when we talked about it last week and how there was just, again, it was getting down to crunch time for Glendale. Gary Bettman on Wednesday before game one acknowledged there were some serious issues here. The ball's in the court of Glendale. He didn't say the puck, but he said the ball. He knows there's a puck involved. But it was noted by Elliot Friedman on Saturday's HNIC Hot Stove that the Canucks wanted to move their AHL team to Seattle, and were told, you can't do that. It won't work for hockey. But yet the Seattle mayor revealed yesterday he's had conversations with Gary Bettman, pretty deep conversations as well, about Seattle getting ready in an 11,000-seat arena for the time being with developer Chris Hansen getting into a key arena next year and playing a season. So this isn't a year and a half away. This is potentially training camp in 9 or 10 weeks for a Seattle NHL team.
And part of the story would be if this happens and Anthony Lanza is one of the investors with a potential Seattle franchise, Jeremy Roenick would have a role in hockey operations to set the whole thing up. This is moving at lightning speed. And the fact that this is being thrown out there and the mayor is involved, you have to think there's a lot of legs to it, that this could very well happen in the next week or so.
And maybe the city feels a little bit spurned by the Sonics are coming back. Well, a Seattle NBA franchise is coming back. Okay, it's not coming back. But I got the sense that the market was, you know, its appetite was whetted much more for basketball than hockey. We've all talked about and I think agreed on the fact that it's good market. A lot of money there.
Worked.
Right?
Right.
And now you throw hockey. I worry just a little bit. I mean, Quebec City would be a fait accompli. I mean, it's the market's there. The fan base would be there. You go to Seattle, I think there's a more risk there, a lot more risk there.
I don't think the corporate support's there in Quebec City that would be there in Seattle.
I agree with that. But then you got the average Joe and Jane fan base that's going to go and fill that arena as well. I understand the money that's there, and there's tons of it in the Pacific Northwest. I'm just not sure about this as a hockey market now, certainly with Quebec City just sitting there waiting.
Well, but a lot of it is winning, too. A lot of it is getting off to a good start. A lot of it is letting your fan base know you're not going to stink for 4 or 5 years. Phoenix didn't do that, right? Atlanta didn't do that. You know, it's been nothing but faulty promises for Florida Panthers fans. Yes, they exist since about 1996. So it's about taking a team there and having some success. I'm excited to see it if it happens. They don't have to realign also if it happens because Phoenix can stay in the West. Natural geographical rivalry with Vancouver, maybe even a little bit of one with San Jose. But we'll see if it transpires.
And they're getting a decent team. That's the key thing. You're getting
an okay team. They're getting a non-playoff team.
But they're not the dregs of the league. They're not right in the bottom. They're not a number one draft pick overall team.
That might be better, though.
Well, I agree.
Colorado would be better. Right?
Exactly.
I don't know. If I'm going to get a team, I want one that's going to be, you have a chance to be competitive. You have some decent talent. If they sign Mike Smith.
Missing the playoffs.
Well, I don't know how competitive they are. Shane Doan may not want to be there. You may have to move him.
You get Dave Tippett back. You have a team.
Do you?
Well, I'm saying that's going to be part and parcel. I think what Jeremy Roenick, if he's running the team, would be his first priorities to make sure you can sign Dave Tippett.
Maybe, but Jeremy Roenick may have some wacky idea about who should coach.
Phil Jackson. Be great. Seattle fans would love him.
Mike Keenan.
Get Mike Milbury in the front office. JR's tight with him. So Phoenix isn't. No, I'm not saying they're in bad shape, but they got a lot of. I don't know. I look at their roster and I see a lot of David Mosses and Antoine Vermets and Martin Hansels and Rob Klinkhammers. I'm not sure. Matthew Lombardi couldn't play for the Leafs, but he could play 31 games for Phoenix.
He's big in Seattle.
Is that right? Sleepless in Seattle. Let's do Now and Then for Monday, June 17th.
Now on Brady and Lang. Now and Then. A contemplative and reflective look back on great and not so great snapshots in time. And 4 minutes of radio Greg and Jim don't have to come up with on their own. Not exactly a string.
On this date in 1971, Richard Nixon declared war on drugs. Nancy Reagan picked this up about 9-10 years later. Just say no. What do you guys feel about drugs? Give me your reaction on drugs. Not on drugs, but reaction to drugs.
I'm anti-drug.
Should we legalize more things? Marijuana?
Never tax it. Never smoke, never inhaled. But,
no, but you
I would agree with that, yes.
Tax it?
Marijuana, I put in the same level as hard liquor. Honestly, and if you're going to make all the money the government does from the LCBO and the beer store, which is massive tax revenue, how much more tax revenue could be poured towards healthcare and education and the infrastructure of this province if you legalize marijuana?
Do we still have a bit of a stigma with it? If somebody in a job interview says, what do you like to do in your spare time? Just kind of kick back. You know, smoke some dube, you know, on a Friday night. It's going to be tough to get that that corporate promotion, isn't it?
Absolutely true. And actually, you know, the reaction would be the same, though, to Jim's point, if I said, what do you like to do on Friday night? Well, you know, I get a bottle of scotch. Yeah.
No, you're still here. but at the same time, no, if you say, yeah, I like going golfing, you know, a couple, look at all the Jameson's ads on TV now, the Wiserhood, the clapping. Come on. I don't have a stigma with that like we do with pot.
But the attitude is changing, and the people in charge of hiring in corporate, you know, corporate world now, the whole demographic has changed to people of our era now are running companies who maybe grew up with it, have a different attitude towards it, who wouldn't think it's that bad of a thing as long as you're productive in your job.
I guess. I've still got the Robert De Niro. Are you a pothead, Focker? I still feel that way about it. NHL announces franchise in this day, 1997. They'll add franchises in Nashville, Florida, and Minnesota, and all of them will compete for the Stanley Cup consistently. Okay, that wasn't part of the announcement. Birthdays, Mike Milbury. Speaking of, how old's Mike Milbury?
57.
58.
He's 61. Greg Kinnear, former TV host and actor. He's still a current actor.
55.
He is 50. Venus Williams is 33. And on this date in 1979, the number one single in the land was off the Grease soundtrack, You're the One That I Want, John Travolta. Travolta put out a pop album now and went on tour. People would go see him, wouldn't they?
Right now?
Yeah.
No, they probably would.
Old ladies would.
They go to Rama or Casino Falls View Casino.
That's fine. But it's still John Travolta on tour. He had this budding music career, and he kind of didn't pursue it.
Did he really have a budding music career?
Or was this more Olivia Newton-John?
Well, she had a very good career also, but... Also, I think he ripped off the Fonz in this movie. I would have sued him if I was Henry Winkler. I never understood that.
Especially the hair.
How do you get away with ripping off the Fonz so blatantly when Happy Days is on? 5:56. It's Brady and Lang. No Fonzies here, just Potsies. 6 o'clock update next with Mike Farwell. It's Brady and Lang, Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Batting leadoff for your day of sports coverage supremacy. This is Brady and Lang on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Adam hits one deep to right center field. A long, high, deep drive. Yes, sir. Let's admire that one. There she goes, sailing right over the Rangers bullpen and deep right center field. The Blue Jays 7, the Rangers nothing as Adam has homered here in back-to-back games.
The hot bat, he's swinging. He's due to go to the All-Star game at Citi Field. Not much doubt about that. Adam Lynn has resurrected his career, and his weekend helped bring the Blue Jays back into full focus in the playoff hunt. Good morning. It's Brady and Lang, Greg Brady, Jim Lang, Mike Farwell. Three things we'll get to before 6:15 this morning. Can either the Hawks or Bruins win the next three hockey games and deny us a game six and maybe an overtime game six as well? And the San Antonio Spurs, now a 3-2 lead, and they won game five exactly how they won game three, shooting from the outside. Are they firmly in the driver's seat, though they won't play at home again? But we begin with the Toronto Blue Jays. We talked about guys the need to put together a winning streak, win five in a row, win six in a row, win 9 out of 11, do something, do anything. And the Blue Jays get it started with a 4-game sweep in Arlington. The Rangers have lost 6 straight. They're reeling now. So you might be able to make the argument they're beating up a really cold baseball team and a bad baseball team, but they helped that process. And now tonight, time to have 3 more games before getting back in the division against the Colorado Rockies. But there is hope. There is some hope to some degree that they won't be totally on the outside looking in and playing meaningless baseball games in August.
And for all the talent on this team, one of the greatest surprises, without question, is seeing Adam Lynn hitting .423 in the month of June. Every time he's at the plate, you expect him to do something. And there was no question he was the hottest hitter this weekend in Texas and provided the offense they needed to go along with that outstanding starting pitching.
And Chin-Meng Wong, you talk about that starting pitching, 7 scoreless innings. So that's back-to-back quality starts from a guy the Blue Jays essentially picked up off the scrap heap, right, out of the Yankees minor league system.
What are the Yankees thinking? No kidding, seriously.
They need some arms themselves.
Chin-Meng Wong hadn't gone 7 shutout innings since April of 2008 and comes up with an absolute gem yesterday. Some of the pitches he was tossing at Texas, I know they were chirping at the ump, but it was outstanding. They didn't have a clue.
Well, and we're to the point now, I think. Adam Lynn hasn't even had enough bats to qualify for the batting title. That'll probably change if he keeps hitting consistently. They weren't playing him at all against lefties earlier on in the season, but it's a pretty remarkable renaissance. I'd even make the case, think about last year at this time, you'd be frying Alex Anthopoulos on a griddle if some other team had picked him up. Decided to pay him the money over the next couple of years. At first, you would have applauded that, and now you'd be looking if he was doing this somewhere else, and especially for a contender, a Baltimore, a Tampa, a team that the Blue Jays had to climb over and get past, either this year, next year, the year after that. If Adam Lynn was doing it elsewhere, you'd be skewering Alex Anthopoulos. They were fortunate he wasn't picked up, but they deserve credit because they've shown patience with him as well all through the rest of last season. Didn't dump him in the offseason and just outright release him. It's the danger for Ricky Romero right now, but if you're a Romero fan, at least it's a cautionary tale. You can have what happened to Adam Lynn, and you can get back. You can play again.
And you can only hope that he's as successful as Adam Lynn that this time next year for Ricky Romero, because with the way Adam Lynn is hitting, I think John Gibbons can put him anywhere in the lineup he wants and feel confident he's going to produce. And he gets up in the batter's box, and he just has that look about him that he is going to dictate the at-bat and wait for the pitch he wants and drive it where he wants. The home run off the breaking ball, and Pat Tabler mentioned it, was a great piece of hitting and didn't try to chase it and cranks it off the foul pole.
And you're getting to the point where I think you're going to see more against lefties. He's only had 25 at-bats against left-handed pitchers, but he's got 13 hits and 25 at-bats. He's hitting .520 against lefties. They've been his bugaboo the last few years. It wasn't even, you know, it was passable a few years ago when he had his really good 2009. Then he was terrible against them last year. Hit .202, hit .243 against lefties in 2011, and .117 against them in 2010. So it's understandable. At best case scenario for Lynn this year was almost to get into a platoon situation at DH, where he was going to be taking the at-bats against righty starters and someone else would have them against left. Now you're inclined to make sure Adam Lynn's in your batting order every day.
I think you'd be crazy not to have him there unless he's tired and needs a break, because he's so locked in at the plate right now. You want to ride the hot bat as long as you can. But as great as Lynn is, the fact that the four starting pitchers had a combined ERA of 0.67 for four games in Texas, even with their struggles, it's still a great lineup the Rangers have. That's one of the great stories this year, to actually four straight games of that quality from the starting pitching this year.
Now, there's a great debate, though. Are they back in it, or are you going to preserve judgment until they're a .500 team? It's been easy, and some people have fairly, I think, buried them and said, hey, no, nothing's mathematically impossible, but it's virtually unthinkable they'll get back in and become a playoff team. They'll have to play this level of baseball, and you're not going to go and sweep many four-game series in many American League parks. It was critical they did last night. Are you thinking that they're back in, or do you still need to see them at .500?
I still need to see them at .500. Not .500 for one day, but .500 and prove it for a good week to 10 days that this is a legit .500 team.
There's no question that's the benchmark for my perspective. And look, I don't want to it's fun to look at the numbers and say 5.5 games out of the wild card, 5-game winning streak, 4 games below .500, et cetera, et cetera. But let's be honest here. They dug themselves so deep a hole, and I know it's a long season. It's that marathon, not the sprint, et cetera, et cetera. No, I don't think this team can overcome all the teams still in front of it to make the playoffs. But it's nice to see right now, and then get to .500, and we'll talk
about it. But also, it helps to leave the Angels in the distance, because we all thought those were two pretty, I'd say it's the Angels, the Blue Jays, the Tigers were three of the five playoff teams. You almost would have inked that in. And it looks like only Detroit out of those three is going to make it in an easier division. But when you look at the wild card standings, I mean, logically, there's only five teams to me that can make the playoffs. Baltimore, Texas, the Yankees, Tampa, and the outside shot is the Blue Jays. So it's everybody in the AL East, and add Texas in for good measure. And that's it. No one else can get in at this point. The Angels, I mean, the Angels had the kind of weekend that the Blue Jays had been having and now sit 2.5 games behind Toronto. Well, if you're 2.5 games behind Toronto and they're that far out, you're in big, big trouble. Lost in their next game, and they're 30-40. You're not going to win 90 games if you're 30-40 unless you go on a hell of a tear.
But you get to .500, you can jump over Kansas City and Cleveland. Then you have a more realistic expectation of, are they really in this wild card race? And that's the goal, and that's why R.A. Dickey said it. And the fact they're playing like this, knowing that Jose Reyes is coming back on the horizon within the next 2 to 3 weeks, I think augurs very well for what could happen just before and just after the All-Star break.
Yeah, and yet they're one bad injury away elsewhere from probably that doing it. They're a Mark Burley DL stint away from being out of it. They're a Bautista DL stint away from being out of it. So they need it all to break their way. They haven't had many breaks so far, and you create your own sometime, but there's light. There is that this weekend that there wasn't, I don't think, 7 days ago. Let's flip it off to basketball now. Spurs with a 114-104 victory over Miami late last night. They got it started a little earlier on Sunday night, but it's all up to the Miami Heat now. Two home games tomorrow night, Thursday night, game six, potentially game seven. They can rest on the idea that this is easily doable, because this happened 3 years ago. The LA Lakers were down 3-2 to Boston, had the two home games at Staples Center, one game six, one game seven. This is what you play all season for the home advantage, especially in the 2-3-2 format, but they will have to defend the outside shot better. I didn't think Danny Green was going to keep making three-pointers. It turns out he was. They were only 9-22 last night. Miami was 11-23. So it's not like there was a great disparity. And Miami actually made more points from outside. But the shots that Green made early put San Antonio up. And Miami just, they were digging, trying to dig like crazy out of that hole. And a couple big spurts, including Manu Ginobili, in on both those spurts. put the heat in the base on the floor, and they couldn't get back up.
We use terms like playoff performer in hockey all the time. Danny Green is becoming the ultimate playoff performer in the NBA this year. He only averaged just over 10 points a game in the regular season, 18 points a game in the postseason in the finals, and he set a new NBA record for the most three-pointers in an NBA final series, and the series isn't even over yet. He's been that dialed in, and I mean, if you're the Heat, wouldn't you assume that all your eggs in the defensive basket are being pushed towards Parker, Ginobili, and Duncan? Why would you have to worry about Danny Green beating you? But he is beating them because he's been so lethal from three-point range.
Cut by the Cavs, cut by the Spurs. Here he is playing such a pivotal role in this NBA Finals with that new record now established for three-pointers. Six more last night. And it's been fascinating to me in watching this series. Game one, pretty nip and tuck. It's a close game. Could have gone either way. Every game since then, the teams have taken
pretty decisive wins,
exactly,
right?
In all four games. Knocking each other on the mat. Yep.
Now, Chris Bosch was fine last night. It was 16-6. Could he shoot more? I guess. James and Wade took 44 shots combined. Bosch only took 11. They didn't, they're playing Mike Miller in these minutes and they're not letting him shoot. They either have to let him shoot or probably put him on the bench. And to me, get Udonis Haslam back in there, who started many an NBA Finals game for Miami before. And it's really interesting how Chris Anderson has sat. The Birdman played in games one and two, was a big factor, banging bodies against Roy Hibbert and obviously against Tyler Hansbrough for the Pacers. But we haven't seen him since game three of this series, and that was garbage time when Miami was getting blown out. But it's kind of intriguing. They don't think he matches up and can cover Duncan, and there's nobody smaller like a splitter that they feel comfortable with him covering. So not that splitter's any smaller than Duncan, but I mean playing a smaller role. So he's sitting on the bench. He wouldn't be the difference, but I'd use him for some defensive minutes, and they haven't.
I don't understand his inactivity whatsoever. I mean, they had Mike Miller play 25 minutes. We know he's not there for offense, but he didn't produce anything, not even a single point.
Yeah, you got to shoot if you're in the lineup if you're Mike Miller. And I don't know that they're telling him not to, but if he's in there and gets his 25 minutes, you're right. He's got to take the opportunity.
I mean, he's credited with one field goal attempt in the game, one shot. Yeah. In 25 minutes. So, I mean, why would the Spurs or Popovich even worry about the guy whatsoever offensively?
He's changed his game. He was a slasher at Florida. He could cut to the basket. He's purely an outside option right now, but they're not using that outside option. But yet, he's probably a more accurate outside option than either Chalmers or James is, and not Ray Allen. But if you're not going to start Ray Allen, and I don't think they are, then you got to utilize Mike Miller probably a bit better. Let's move to Stanley Cup Finals. We'll talk lots about it with Scott Morrison later this morning at 7:20. But Boston's alive, and I feel like they would have been anyway. A lot of people might have said series over had Chicago won in overtime. But I think especially in the last couple of years, and especially with what we saw happen to the Bruins against the Canucks 2 years ago, it would not have been. But they get it over just a little bit sooner than the Marathon Wednesday game. Daniel Paille scores 13:48 into overtime from Sagan and McQuaid. Not a huge shot disparity. I guess the Blackhawks might have a beef, though, with the Hossa goal that was called off, to be totally honest. Yeah, you can't just say, well, then it doesn't go to overtime because the game would shift and Boston would press more in the third period. And we don't know whether it would have been a 2-2 game going to overtime. But I can't stand a rule where the referee says, hey, I meant to blow the whistle and just didn't get out of time. You don't see that. I meant to call a foul there. I meant to throw a flag there. I meant to call a strike instead of a ball, but we allow this in hockey.
There's no question this had a huge role in the game Saturday night, considering how tight it was, how pivotal it was, how momentum swung back in Boston's favor in the third period when they had a little more energy and a little more jump, and in overtime when they outchanced Chicago. Would have been a completely different game.
You want to blow the whistle, just blow the whistle. It's as simple as that.
And if you didn't blow the whistle, it's in your mouth.
Yeah, and if you didn't blow it, guess what? You didn't blow it.
It's not like me looking for my car keys in the morning. It's not like that at all. So 6:15, yeah, it is similar. 6:15, Brady and Lang. We'll deal more with the NHL, talk about the Seattle possibility, and Alex Ovechkin, not a popular choice, it seems, at all for the Hart Trophy. Why is that? We'll deal with it next, 6:16. It's Brady and Lang on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Now, more of Brady and Lang on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
On the boards, McQuaid holds it in. Right side, Sagan. Paille, left circle. Rickshot, score! Sam Paille from the left wing side wins it an OT! And the Bruins split the first two games in Chicago!
Jack Edwards on the call on the Bruins Radio Network. Game two goes to Beantown. The series now in Beantown, and it goes tonight and Wednesday. No more two-day breaks in between for the time being. They'll play Monday, Wednesday this week before shifting it back. We know there will be a Game 5 in Chicago. The great question is, will there be a Game 6? We'll get to this Alex Ovechkin issue in just a little bit. But as we brought it to you off the top and talked about it, Game 3 tonight. And it's difficult to think that the games can be any closer. That's obvious given there's been overtime. But at the same time, I wonder if Game 2 will feel like one that got away from the Blackhawks based on their first period. Boston just didn't look ready to play. Fatigue shouldn't have been an issue even this deep into the playoffs, because if both teams played the triple overtime, it's one thing during the regular season if you had a triple overtime game, then you go Saturday, team's been waiting there and they're fresh, then you might see a difference. That wasn't the case. Both teams had to play in game one. Both teams weren't exactly equal in the first period of game two. Chicago just couldn't get the extra goal, and the one was called off that was quite controversial. They never scored again after Patrick Sharp's goal in the first.
And Boston did outshoot Chicago the second, third period, and overtime after that disastrous first period. And that was either Claude Julien reading him the riot act or the players in the dressing room deciding, what are we doing out there? And they took the play to Chicago, especially late in the third into OT, to end up with that victory.
And not even just getting outshot, but 17 shots total for the Blackhawks, second, third, and overtime. That's a lot of hockey. That's 53 minutes of hockey. You're throwing a shot at the net every 4 minutes. You're not going to win that way.
Shots don't always tell the story. It can be a misleading statistic.
Hits,
yeah, sure. And zone entry is a huge part of it all, too.
Right.
But in this case,
also.
In this case, it really was a big part of that game on Saturday night, because the Chicago Blackhawks were not allowing the Boston Bruins a whole heck of a lot in the early part of that game. Or you can look at it the other way and say the Bruins weren't generating. But either way, those shot totals were indicative of the kind of game we were seeing.
Who has to be better? I'll start and say I've been banging this drum. It's Jonathan Toews, isn't it? I mean, he's got one goal in this entire postseason. And it was in a 4-1 win against Detroit. It was kind of a garbage time goal. I'm sorry. I mean, that's the difference to me between very good player and superstar. I understand very good players sometimes doesn't go in. Let's not put this guy in superstar category, Hart Trophy nominee category. If he's going to toss up one goal in 20-plus playoff games with the amount of ice time he's getting, and he's not injured, all that's factor, he has to be much better than he's been.
Oh, it's a great cute story that Brian Bickle and Andrew Shaw scoring goals, but Toews is the man in Chicago. If he's not scoring goals and they end up losing the series, that has to rest a lot on his shoulders. He's the man. He's the captain. He's supposed to be the center point of the face of the franchise. Then he has to be so much better.
There's no question that Toews is the man with the crosshairs pointed directly at him in Chicago. On the other side of the equation, though, don't you look at Jaromir Jagr and say, I get that you're an elder statesman. I get that you're out there and the effort absolutely seems to be there, but scoreless. If I said to you before these playoffs started that Jaromir Jagr would not score,
I can't figure out how it's happened. I don't see a guy playing bad hockey. So I don't know what more, but again,
you need the production. You need the production from this guy.
You do, but this is a little like how we debated Kessel in the first 10 games of the regular season. What's he supposed to do? Like, let's not change who he is. Jagr's not very fast right now. Jagr's not going to, burn you on a breakaway. So how does he get more opportunities than he's already getting? He's around the puck constantly. The puck's like a magnet near him. What's he do?
Tyler Seguin, in my mind, is the guy in Boston that needs to step up more. He's got
the overtime winner wasn't enough.
Setting up the overtime winner,
but that was nice. But think about
leading. It was nice to change the series.
But the playoffs up until then, he's got 64 shots in goal, and he's only got one goal. He's an offensive player that needs to bury it more.
Toews. We don't lump him in the Toews category.
But he's more important offensively to Boston than a 41-year-old Jagr. He doesn't have the excuse of age or he's tired or anything. He's 21 years old. He should be far more productive.
Is his excuse that he's 20?
Well, I think, and you remember,
is that fair?
I don't think it's necessarily fair, but I think with all the other players on Boston, and you look at the minutes that Sagan's getting, I mean, he's not playing a pivotal role. He's not being asked to do a whole lot for this Boston team. I look at Jagr and I look at the deal that Aginla, when he chose Pittsburgh over Boston, so Boston goes out and their safety valve was Jaromir Jagr, and I get that he's playing good hockey. I'm not knocking
I'd
that.
I'd rather have him than Aginla the rest of the series.
But they got him. They didn't get him to get seven assists. They didn't get him to get seven assists in the playoffs. They got him to score goals.
We'll see. But again, you're not telling me what else you would have him do differently. You don't think it's effort.
He's got to score.
So the goalie not be as good. That's what you're asking Yarmir Yager to do.
Come on, this is Yarmir freaking Yager.
Don't be as good if you're Corey Crawford.
This is Yarmir Yager.
I know it's Yarmir Yager. The other guy's Jonathan Toews.
Yeah, I thought you were talking. The other guy was Corey Crawford.
But what I'm saying is I'm seeing things in Toews' game that doesn't indicate to me a superstar play. I'm not seeing what Yager's doing. To some extent, I get the Sagan criticism, but I'm not seeing what Yager's not doing that you'd want him to do. Eventually, the puck has to go in. It's like Kessel. Kessel didn't do anything differently from games 11 through 48. You guys were banging his drum like nobody. He has to. Something's got to happen. Well, do we put him on the third line? Should he go to the net more? Should he stand in front of the net?
Yager gets to play.
Just keep doing it.
He gets to play the special six-round Stanley Cup playoffs because eventually the goals are going to start coming for him. Come on.
No one's told him the World Championships aren't over yet.
He
still wants to go.
He's got 700 career goals. He can find one or two in the playoffs at a critical time, like overtime the other night.
If that puck was half an inch inside that post in the tip of the double overtime at the end, we're not having this conversation because he would have scored the game winner in game one.
Yeah, but he didn't.
He didn't. Why he didn't, I don't know. He is as snake-bitten as a sniper as you've ever seen. He is getting opportunities and shots, but for whatever reason, he can't put it by the goalie.
All right, Toews, 4 playoff goals in his last 41 playoff games. 26 minutes a night, every damn night. So there's that. We'll watch him tonight a little more carefully than maybe we would otherwise, but I've yet to hear the analysts, again, if the guy was roommates with Mikhail Grabowski growing up, we'd be killing him.
Let's say this about Yager. At no time in the postseason has any member of the Bruins had to skate over the penalty box to tell him to calm down and not taking dumb penalties and not lose his bleep.
He's
got to
skate
ice.
Fast enough to take penalties, so that's not his game anymore.
Is it called cruising or is it?
I don't know. He's got different gear, that's for sure. So Alex Ovechkin, they announced on the weekends, the Hart Trophy nominee, or the Hart Trophy winner, beats out John Tavares and beats out Sidney Crosby. Now, there's a lot of criticism of Ovechkin winning the award. He's now got it 3 times, and the only men who've won this award post-expansion 3 times, Wayne Gretzky, Mario Lemieux, Bobby Orr, Bobby Clark. That's quite a list for Ovechkin to join. If Sidney Crosby wins 2 more Hart trophies, he'll have had a pretty good career. If Malkin, Perry, I think the ship sailed for Hank Sedin to do that. But it's incredibly difficult to win one. He's won 3, and no one would rule out a 4th. Why do you think it's being criticized so much, him winning? It's not like there was 1-2 obvious candidates. A lot of people now want to give it to Crosby, despite the fact they said, well, he only played 3/4 of the games. Now Ovechkin's getting credit. Well, you only scored as many as Crosby in the first 36 games. Yeah, but the finish was unbelievable for Alexander Ovechkin.
24 goals his last 29 games. And that was the only reason the Capitals got into the postseason, because he was so prolific. He's getting hammered, Greg, because he's the wild Russian. He lives the rock star lifestyle.
He's engaged, though.
He's engaged, but he doesn't fit the mold of the humble, quiet Canadian hockey superstar. And I think he takes a lot of grief for that. And he's also getting grief because the Capitals did win in the playoffs, even though it's an award based on your regular season.
That's the biggest criticism from my perspective. That's why people perceive him to be a lesser player, because Washington underachieved for the entire season.
Because they're out right now.
And then they made a nice push towards the end. They squeak into the playoffs. They get knocked out in the first round. That, to me, is where the criticism comes from. I don't necessarily buy into the narrative that this is about him not being a humble Canadian kid. It's the fact that he was not able to elevate his team to, say, the same heights that Sidney Crosby was, supporting cast be damned.
So it's not the type of player specifically.
I don't think so.
It's him specifically and his team's untimely fate getting knocked out. Plus, they get knocked out. They blow a 3-2 lead in the series, lose to the Rangers. Nobody scores a goal in the last 2 games. Lundqvist finishes with back-to-back shutouts. And then it's also the Rangers go so meekly. It's not even that you lost. Now you lost to a team that went very quietly. But everyone's gone quietly to the Bruins. Pittsburgh went quietly to the Bruins. So if we gave the award to Crosby, we'd somehow make an excuse, because we'd say, well, that was pre-broken jaw Crosby MVP, right? We'd say that's when he won, was the 36th game. We're not going to count the 4 games in which he vanished, and Malkin vanished, and Iginla vanished, and Morrow vanished. We're not going to count that against him, but we do it to Ovechkin.
And a lot of the media members point to Crosby. He has a gold medal. He has a Stanley Cup ring, justifying the kind of player he is. And fair or not, until Ovechkin goes to the promised land and wins a Stanley Cup, they'll always hold that against him, no matter how many Hart trophies he wins for his regular season greatness.
But I won't, and he's obviously a first ballot Hall of Famer. He's a first ballot Hall of Famer if he quits this summer. Some people might try and keep him out. You honestly should get your vote taken away if you're trying to keep him out.
You can't keep him out.
There's no way he can stay out. He's just been too good of a player in his career.
We'll get to a little more on the Stanley Cup Finals. Back to the Blue Jays as well. Let's do the money game on Sportsnet 590 The Fan, brought to you by your GTA Acura retailers. During Acura's Season to Drive sales event, even their offers outperform with nothing down and a $3,000 cash credit on the 2013 ILX. See your retailer for details. Here's Mike Eppel.
Outperformance on the markets this morning, guys. We're watching the Dow futures surge 140 points. That is setting the stage for a very good start to the trading week. We're coming off some back-to-back weekly losses, though, for international markets, so we're hoping for a bounce, and this week may just tell the tale about the future of the markets going into the summer, with the U.S. Federal Reserve set to make a decision on interest rate policy on Wednesday, and there's speculation that they may just extend all of the economic stimulus measures. Everybody's betting on that in the early trade so far this morning. We start the week with the price for oil. Quite expensive, actually. Almost $100 a barrel. What's going on in Syria? The violence there. Middle East supply risk. It's been pumping up the price for oil. A little bit more demand as we're into getting close to the start of summer. More driving, obviously, specifically in the United States, the economy seems to be improving. So this morning I saw gas posted at $1.29 per liter. That's quite expensive again. The Canadian dollar is at 98.5 cents U.S. We've got the G8 summit in Ireland for the next couple of days. The Paris Air Show is underway. Airbus making some big sales already, multi-billion-dollar contracts. And also this week, we'll hear the comments from our central bank governor, Stephen Poloz. He gives a speech in Oakville midweek and Q&A session and all sorts of speculation about what he plans for interest rate policy here. So a busy week to start things off.
We'll get more at 8:30.
Thank you.
Mike Eppel dropping a lot on us at 6:30. We'll talk to him again in a couple hours. Coming up, Phil Mickelson. Is the treatment of his second place finish a little too on the hefty side? No pun intended. Yeah, she looks good. Just tired. And a former NFL great, in fact, an NFL Pro Football Hall of Famer, says the NFL won't be around in 10 or 20 years. And then he apologized why he did that. Next.
Now, more of Brady and Lang on Sportsnet 590. The Fan.
You will not make this, jackass.
One more look.
Shot is on the way. Good clean contact. Mickelson running up the hill. And just misses on the right-hand side. And Phil Mickelson, after hitting the green, head goes down.
Jackass.
It's a big win for Justin Rose. Finally gets his major at the age of 32. A fourth round 70. The most consistent golfer wins the title 71, 69, 71, and 70. And what had eluded him so far may elude him no longer. And this is probably one of the guys that has won. Rory McIlroy was an obvious one who you said, well, it's not just going to be a one-off. You feel that way about Rose, where there have been a lot of guys, your Charles Schwartzels, in the last several years, who you just feel like they're going to win. They're going to be Ben Curtis, Rich Beam, and we're not going to hear from them again. Rose has a great opportunity, obviously. Forget about how well-liked he is. Forget about the politeness. But he's got a great opportunity with his game, and always has since he was about 16 years old, to win in this kind of level.
And he put it all together in a magnificent display of golf in brutal conditions. He was the only golfer of the final four pairings to shoot 70. Everybody else, guys like Schwartzel, you mentioned, shot a 78. Billy Horschel with those weird octopus pants, 74. And Mickelson shot 74. And that's it in a nutshell. He was making the shots the other top contenders just couldn't pull off.
We'll talk to Ian Leggett about it at 7:40 this morning. But the coverage wrapped up probably around 7:45, leading into 8 o'clock. Bob Costas did an interview with Justin Rose. They didn't have that weird bird calling guy interrupting. Remember how cold it was last year that you could see the breath coming from the bird man's mouth? And they were able to have a little bit better security on the course in Pennsylvania than they did last year at the U.S. Open. But either way, he wasn't interrupted. But so much of the coverage was about Mickelson. He talked frankly about how heartbroken he was that he didn't win, thought it was his best chance. I don't know that it was. I think he had caught up in the moment. And that's understandable given how much he'd been through in the last 4 or 5 days. But I just felt the coverage really, really unfair towards Mickelson. I want to know if anybody else did. 416-870-0590, star 590. You can call us as well, 888-666-0590. It's 416-870-0590. The amount of golfers out there, your Lee Westwoods, your Matt Kuchers. Matt Kuchar was the hot amateur 15 years ago. He hasn't come close to winning a major. Wes Woods had close calls. Luke Donald's had many a close call and had another top 10 finish. That used to be the theme, was sort of the best golfer that didn't win. And though Phil didn't gag this away, not by any stretch, he never led by two shots on the day. Never had, you know, that hole. Never had a triple bogey. Didn't go Vandeveld on anybody with the lead. Gets roasted. Seems like to me, they showed maybe 9 of his 74 strokes they showed in a montage at the end. As I noted on Twitter, all they're missing is Beck's loser playing underneath for a guy that finished tied for second.
I don't understand why they're trying to spin it this way, Greg. He's a Hall of Fame golfer. You talked about Ovechkin being a first ballot Hall of Famer in the NHL. Phil Mickelson's had a Hall of Fame career most golfers could only dream of. It's the whole culmination of the cult of Phil. It was Father's Day. He flew home.
It's his birthday, right?
It's his birthday, right. His daughter's graduation. They want him to be the man. They want him to take the mantle because he's the anti-Tiger. He's a golfer that in my house, my wife and kids don't really know golf, but they know and like Phil. They view him as the family guy, and they want him to do well. And I think a lot of middle America root for the guy.
So who's Justin Rose? Who's Justin Rose coming into yesterday? Who's Justin Rose coming into Sunday? You just touched on all of the reasons that a TV producer, and in yesterday's case, the director sitting there in that truck, has said Phil's the leader coming into Sunday. He started this tournament with the, you know, daughter's graduation
story. He's our story. We stay on him.
Right? And he is the story. Look, people know Phil Mickelson. You said, if you said Phil Mickelson to 10 people on the street last Thursday, you'd get 7 or 8 knowing who he is. You say Justin Rose, you're not going to get the same response. He's the story because he's Phil Mickelson.
But can you emphasize the story and say it's more another close call? If you tuned in, if you woke up from a hefty nap and missed all the coverage and just watched the end and watched the winner's interview and the loser's interview, you're like, God, what'd he blow? 5-shot lead? 7-shot lead? 8-shot lead? That's how it was perceived. I'm saying I know the cameras have got to be in front of him, Mike, and he's got to talk. And he's going to be disappointed, but don't make the narrative that, God, he just gagged this one away. That was the narrative at the end of the day. It's not fair to him.
It's only fair if on the last three holes, he pulled every tee shot deep into the rough and blew the lead. And Justin basically was handed the victory because he collapsed.
But
that would have been justified.
He missed the putt on the 16th, you know, by an inch. It didn't break as far right as he thought. And he didn't even rim the cup left. He just missed it left. And that was the end of it. It was going to be an impossible task to birdie 18.
But what about 13 when he's got the par 3 there?
That was as good a chance, but I think 16 was as good a chance.
But that goes to show the little areas within the round where Phil had a chance to stay there maybe for the playoff.
But everybody has it. But there weren't plenty of golfers in majors that have chance. Jason Day had chances.
But everybody wasn't leading going into Sunday like Phil was.
By one shot.
Well, but he was. He was the leader. And he wasn't at the end of it. So he blew it.
I'll ask you guys this. Had he won a U.S. Open previously, is it less of a story? Like, this is somehow the one that eludes him and never can get, you know, can finish on Father's Day. He's won 2 Masters.
It's far less of a story. He blew it the year he cranked that shot on the 18th, deep into the valley.
And I would have understood all the coverage of it then. The story's the shot. There's not one shot. We're gonna pound a guy into the ground with a hammer on a nail for missing for not making a 15-foot birdie putt on tough greens where only who finished under par in the whole tournament? Nobody, not one person. Mel Lastman, nobody.
Because
nobody
the course
did.
Was set up that tough, and he did hole out on 10 for an eagle. For an incredible approach shot.
I should mention the 3 Masters and the PGA Championship. I don't think if he loses the Open next month, the British Open, it's kind of the same casting. There's something about the U.S. Open, and people want to make this a huge story because he's been second 6 times. This isn't the I don't think this is the Buffalo Bills. The story at the end of the day is still the Bills' accomplishment in getting to the AFC title game and winning it 4 years in a row, right?
America wants Mickelson to win this so bad. They want a great American golfer to win the U.S. Open, and they view him as the quintessential American family man, and it's always on Father's Day weekend. They want him to win.
Gamble's like a son of a bitch, though, Jim. You might be overemphasizing the family man thing a little bit. Stephen Hamilton, you're on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Go ahead, Stephen.
Hi, guys. Let me just say I'm on my way back. I'm stuck in traffic. I'm on my way back from the U.S. Open. I was there on Sunday. I followed Phil pretty much his whole round.
Yeah.
And this was my 11th U.S. Open in 12 years.
You're a maniac.
Phil Mickelson blew this one, just like he did at Wingfoot when I was there at Wingfoot. I was there on 17 when I saw him come up on a must-make birdie putt. He came up 5 feet short. I can guarantee you major championship winners don't come up 5 feet short on a must-make putt. A par does you no good.
That well, that's an inaccurate statement. He's a major championship winner, and he came up short on this day. But how is the criticism so vehement towards him? It's not to Luke Donald. It's not to Lee Westwood. Where are these guys? It was like that with Darren Clark before he won.
I get that. I have always said I don't think Luke Donald has a major in him, and I'm so far right.
Yep.
My only point with Phil is I've thought at Bethpage the same thing. A must-make putt coming up 5 feet short. It just seems like when it's a U.S. Open, it's like the Greg Norman thing. He wants it so bad that he just can't get it. And, you know, he can win a Masters, he can win a PGA, but he wants the U.S. Open so bad that he can't get out of his own way. And I've seen it time and time again with this guy. He will never win this tournament, and he'll never get any closer than he was yesterday. He shoots even par yesterday, he wins.
Yep,
Mike Weir shot 69 on that course yesterday. So it was out there. He shoots even par. He's a U.S. Open champion. It's as simple as that.
Thanks for the phone call, Steve. Appreciate you calling from on the way back. But there's the invocation of Greg Norman. It isn't Greg Norman. There wasn't an 8-shot lead to blow. There wasn't a huge... Like Norman's physical gifts and his mental gifts are the stuff of legend. But at the same time, you look at Norman and you easily say there's a guy that should have won 8 majors. And he only won 2.
His game was equally easily set up to win that and then many more.
But I just, God, I don't look at this as some disaster for Mickelson yesterday. People are like, how's he going to rebound from this? I don't know. He's finished second 6 times and eventually gone on to win other tournaments, including majors. So he might rebound, amazingly enough. Francis in Fort Erie, you're on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Go ahead, Francis.
Thanks for having me, Paul.
Sure.
You know, I'm totally, you're not going to like, I'm an anti-Mickelson fan. I mean, two double bogeys at front nine, and as the other caller alluded to, he seems to be a choke. You know what I mean? I don't see the family guy that you see. I find him to actually kind of phony, like a phony.
There's a lot of guys that think that.
And I don't know. I don't see it that way. If you've had the opportunity there, I mean, he had that eagle. To be honest, I thought at that point that he was going to win it, you know. And, you know, unfortunately for him, he really choked again for the 6th time.
You don't see that as Rose going and getting it then? You know, I mean...
Oh, it's obviously a combination. I mean, I thought that was a great battle. You know, Rose deserves it. But it was Phil's to take, in my opinion. When you're the leader and it's your long sought-after major... You know, he's the hometown favorite or whatever. He should have won it.
Yeah, I suppose it's hard to judge for me. The last hole is also hard to judge because he needs to hole it out. So I don't buy the idea that it's a bogey in his second place tie. If it's a par to win, he's laying up and he's not trying to gun for the pin. He shot it 20 feet past and left himself a really tough putt on the way back. So I don't quibble about whether he should have scored a 73, 74. If he pars 18, it's a 73. It's not a big deal to me.
Having a few putts, not drain a few putts in the back nine is one thing, but yanking your tee shot in 18 like he did a number of years ago deep into the woods is far worse.
Quick thought on Lem Barney, former Detroit Lion, had these comments. USA Today put them in their website over the weekend. Said on Friday, told a panel of football coaches, football is becoming more deadly and won't survive another 20 years. Now, he apologized yesterday because he happened to say it at a camp about football and safety. But he's been talking at Congress under oath. I don't know. To me, he's getting kind of unfairly castigated for this. Many ex-NFLers are saying similar things. The game's in danger. The future's in danger. How many NFLers are, I won't let my kid play it. I'm good. I made my money, so my kid now doesn't have to play. It's like going to war. It's like going into the salt mine. You do it so other generations don't have to.
A big part of this is trying to figure out these old players is how to make the game more like it was when they played, that they felt that they played a tough physical game, but there weren't so many horrible injuries that they're witnessing right now. And they're seeing all their contemporaries they played with bad hips, bad knees, dementia, problems with post-concussion syndrome, and wondering what's to blame. Is it the equipment? Is it the game itself? Are they too big? Eventually, football has to come to sort of a watershed moment in how to keep the game alive beyond 20 years, keep it physical without these horrible long-term injuries.
And I don't know that there's demand by the public for a safer sport. you're not playing, you don't want it dialed. You don't want the physicality dialed down, do you?
You're at the draft every year when there's hundreds of 21-year-old men crying, doing anything to get into this and sign up and be part of it.
They want their 5 or 6 years in the sport, and they want their millions, and they've worked for it since they've been 8 or 9 years old. 6:55, 7 o'clock update on the way. We'll give you a set of Rockies Blue Jays tickets coming up next.